answer it, he said. Hello? I asked. The caller had no ID and no icon. Who's there?
It's me, McGill, said Claver. I'm sorry to have to make this call, but I'm a man of my word when a deal's been struck. I thought I owed it to you to let you know what happened up here.
My heart sank. What do you mean, sir?
The Saurians aren't going for it. Unfortunately, they aren't as dumb as real lizards. They don't want to change their plans just because I've made some kind of under-the-table deal. I'm going to have to drop the hammer on you and your troops.
Sir, I said quickly, I've managed to talk the Tribune into sweetening the offer. I explained we would set him up as a dealer and give him the contents of the mines that were already processed and refined. Claver sounded truly regretful to turn me down.
That is tempting, boy, he said, and I wish I could take it, but I'll be permed myself if I do. The Saurians have a gun to my head, literally.
Throughout this exchange, Tribune Drusus watched me frowning curiously. He could hear both ends of the conversation as I was using the speakers on my tapper and talking out loud. I might have made the call more private if I'd known who was calling, but what was done was done. I looked up at the gray clouds, expecting falling streaks of light to come down and burn me to a cinder at any second. "Stall them," I said. "Stall them as long as you can, Claver."
"What's the point?"
he asked. I told him then about the drones we were flying in every direction. "The deal could still be on," I said. "Just give us 24 hours. Tell them you need to recalibrate or something. Let us spread ourselves out a little, and the odds we'll be permed will be much lower. If we breathe again, even in another place, in another time, the deal is still on."
Okay, but one more thing. I want assurance from Drusus that if I'm permed by these reptiles, I'll catch a revive from your people and be set free afterward.
I looked at Drusus, who appeared troubled, but resigned. He leaned closer to my tapper. "This is Tribune Drusus," he said. "Check my voice print. On my word, I'll revive and release you, if you require the service, after this disastrous campaign." Claver chuckled.
Well, Tribune, he said. I should have known you were lurking nearby and coaching McGill. He's not smart enough to maneuver old Claver by himself. It's a deal.
The channel closed, and we were left to gaze at the skies in apprehension. Drusus studied me, rather than the clouds, after a minute or so. What did you mean when you told him you'd managed to sweeten the deal by adding trading rights? Isn't that what Claver wanted in the first place? I straightened my shoulders, but I didn't meet his eye. Did I say something like that? I'm sorry, sir. I must have been nervous and misspoke.
Right.
McGill, you're without a doubt the most peculiar non-com I've ever met. Just when I think I understand all your twists and turns, you spring another one on me. Sometimes I worry that I've got a youthful version of Claver in the midst of my own team, hiding in plain sight. I looked at him and frowned. I find that suggestion offensive, sir. I've been working hard to save our collective butts. You may not know everything that's in my head, but I'd appreciate it if you'd at least recognize positive results when they're reached. Drusus shook his head bemusedly. Lectured sternly by a man who's less than a third my age, I stand rebuffed. But as to recognition and gratitude, remember your rapid rise in rank, despite 1,000 infractions. He walked away, and I regretted having smarted off to him that way. I gazed up at the skies, wondering as to our fate. It really was hard to think clearly with a mass of fusion shells waiting to rain down upon my head. 21 long hours passed before the skies spoke to me again. Just in case Claver needed a little more encouragement, I'd spent most of that time pacing around on the surface, watching my tapper. According to the techs who'd set up the dishes to track the Saurian ships, all seven had remained parked in orbit. That couldn't be a good sign. Maybe Klaver had come up with a temporary dodge, telling them the broadsides weren't workable for a set period. That would mean he'd followed our agreement to the letter, if not the spirit of it. If that was the situation, I was as good as dead. At least our drones had managed to spread all over the planet now that the Saurians weren't around to shoot them down. If some of them managed to keep from being eaten by the local fauna for the next year or so, we should catch a revive. Maybe. At the crack of the 21st hour, something finally happened. It started off as a streak of blue-white. I'd seen it before, and I had expected it. The first shell was coming down, falling right toward my position. I stared at it unblinking. As a man who's experienced death more times than I can count, I wanted to end it all without cringing. I watched with my spine straight, my mouth clamped closed, and my guts still in my belly. Only at the last second did I realize anything was wrong. The flare of retros, that wasn't right. Shells didn't slow themselves down as they plunged to the ground. Instead of air bursting and creating a mushroom cloud, some tiny portion of which contained my fragmented molecules, the falling object blossomed with white flame and landed. When it thudded into the ground, not 100 meters downslope, I ran to it. My mind was full of possibilities. Could it be Klaver himself? Clearly, it was a life pod. Who else would be crazy enough to come down here now? I cranked open the hatch, which had bent a little after rolling down the side of the mountain a few meters. Inside, there was nothing living. There was only a polyhedral crate and a note. Ripping loose the note, I saw scrawled handwriting.
"I've been executed. Remember our deal, dummy."
It was signed Klaver. I opened the crate and stared at the contents. There was a deep link unit inside. For the first time in days, I dared to grin. Chapter 50. My delight was short-lived. Not 10 minutes after I had dragged the crate containing the deep link unit out of the life pod and carried it to the mine entrance, the sky erupted again. This time the flash and thunder of explosions were unmistakable. Something else was happening up there, something big. I heaved the crate onto my back and trotted into the tunnels, grunting with every step. My breath came in puffs, but I didn't slow down. I lumbered awkwardly into the dark and downward. My left foot dragged behind, but I forced myself to endure the pain. I wished I was still wearing powered armor to help me along, but I'd given that up. The rest of my Legion brothers were down there, deep in the mountain, huddling in the lowest tunnels and hoping against hope they'd live to see the morrow. As far as I knew, I was the only crazy son of a bitch wandering around on the surface with the exception of a few drones that tended the sensors and comm dishes. It took me the better part of an hour to reach my comrades. By that time, my muscles were trembling from exertion. The burden on my back, heavier than a full-grown man, had long ago given me an ache I wouldn't soon forget. My limping, bad leg had only made matters worse. Finally, I tottered into the caverns, where I was met with the last thing I'd expected. Jubilant comrades.
"They did it, McGill!"
shouted Carlos, clapping me on the shoulder. I dropped the deep link as gently as I could and let myself flop down on my back beside it.
"Did what?"
I asked.
"Haven't you been watching the tactical displays? The show has been better than a ball game."
"I've been carrying this box down from the surface." Carlos shook his head and loomed over me. He looked down and grinned.
"You mean you don't know?"
I wanted to kick him, but I was too tired. Instead, I closed my eyes and shook my head.
"The squids came back, man," he said. "We watched it all, live. The Saurian ships met them and they fought. There were 11 squid ships, and the Saurians still blew them away. It turns out Imperial broadsides are good for something besides wrecking innocent planets. They toasted all the enemy ships."
Frowning, I knew something didn't add up. After a moment, I had it.
"But wait," I said. "The Saurians didn't have the right license to fire the broadsides. Graves mentioned that in the unit announcement, Carlo said. I guess there is a clause that allows them to fire in self-defense. The Empire owns those ships, and they don't want them destroyed just because no one aboard has a license. They can fire as long as the other side fires first. I thought about it hazily for a second, still lying on the ground. What a strange, twisted-up set of rules we lived by. Life under the Galactic Empire had always been like that. You often couldn't do what came naturally. You had to check and triple-check countless rules. I could imagine the Saurian commanders taking the first few strikes while frantically reading their contracts and consulting with legal experts. In the end, they'd apparently decided they were allowed to use the big guns and had unleashed their power. Struggling to get up, I groaned. Carlos lifted me to my feet. He frowned at my leg.
You've got to do something about that leg, man.
Later. What about the Saurian ships? How many did they lose?
5 of them went down. Isn't that great? Only 2 escaped the system. That'll serve those lizards right. They came out here and got themselves snotted, up, down, and sideways. Couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch, huh?
Another thought occurred to me as I pushed him aside and headed to the command chamber. Maybe I wasn't the hero of the hour. The Saurians had been still sitting in orbit, plotting our destruction right up until the squids had attacked. That meant they hadn't given up. Maybe they'd been searching for a way they could legally bombard us, or even calling for a Nairb judgment in their favor. Quite possibly all Claver and I had been able to do was delay them long enough and tie them up in a legal argument until another enemy arrived. Tired and sore, I ordered a few lounging recruits to carry the crate for me, which they did without complaint. When I got to the officers' chambers, I was challenged by guards, but they let me through when they figured out who I was. Apparently, they had orders to let me pass. Tribune Drusus met my eyes the moment I arrived. He looked at me with a mixture of wonder and mistrust.
"Was this battle in space part of your grand scheme as well, veteran?"
he asked. Everyone was staring at me in silence. I felt those eyes. A dozen officers were present, and as many more non-coms. They were curious. They wanted to know how this attack had fallen into place. I wanted to lie. I wanted to take credit for all of it. But I knew that was a bad path. I couldn't back up any fanciful stories. Whatever I said would fall apart in the end. "Sometimes," I said vaguely, "a man just gets lucky, sir. I do have one more gift for you, however. A deep link unit." That got the attention of everyone, especially the techs. They swarmed me like a pack of hungry coyotes, investigating the crate like it was roadkill. Natasha herself was on hand when the box was opened and did a full diagnostics check on the unit. "The system appears operational," she said a minute later. "Except for power. There's no cell. I think we can work around that, though." The techs then carted it off to their workshop. Natasha stayed behind and gave me a real smile. "I don't know how you got this," she said, "but you must have dragged it all the way down here from the surface."
"On my back," I admitted. "I'm a little sore."
She kissed me then, and I smiled. Then she was gone, chasing after the deep link unit with the rest of the techs. You'd have thought it was Christmas. The excitement of the day turned into exhaustion after that. I found my way to my kit in a lonely chamber. My spider silk bag was there, and I have to admit I'd never felt anything quite as good as the moment I eased myself into it. I awoke an unknown number of hours later. The chamber was dark, except for a few small, glaring lights. "Have you got the IV in?" asked a female voice. "He's waking up."
"I've got it. I've got it,"
Carlos said. I frowned. Carlos with an intravenous needle? The thought was horrific. Struggling into a sitting position, I caused both of them to squawk and scramble.
"Hey, buddy, just relax," Carlos said.
The other voice turned out to be Anne's. I hadn't recognized her at first. I realized then that I'd been drugged.
"What are you two doing?" I demanded. "Just lie back and relax," Carlos said. We'll be done in about... My big hand lashed out and grasped Carlos's neck. I've got fingers that are longer than normal. It comes with being over 2 meters tall. I squeezed until his eyes bulged.
Get that IV out of my arm, you ghoul,
I said, slurring my words. Anne's face came up into my swimming vision. I glared at them both with mistrust.
James, she said calmly, this isn't an attack. We're trying to fix your leg. I'm not a bad grow,
I lied in a growling voice.
Of course not,
Anne said soothingly.
We're not running you through a revival machine. That would have been easier, but we're trying to fix it the old-fashioned way.
I looked down at my leg then. It was a bloody mess. She had it open with clamps and artificial veins pumping. They'd bypassed my femoral artery with a smart shunt, and it was pulsating rhythmically.
What the hell are you guys doing?
We were ordered to kill you and recycle, Anne said. Graves won't stand for a man with a limp in his unit. Now could you please let go of my orderly's neck before he passes out?
I looked at Carlos. He was dressed in surgical greens and his face was purple. Both his hands were working on my fingers trying to pull them loose, but he couldn't do it. I was holding on to him and squeezing with the strength of a berserk.
Sorry,
I said, finally letting him go. I lay back down and barely heard his stream of curses and coughs.
You ungrateful ape, he complained. My first time in surgery, and the patient tries to kill me. This sucks worse than I expected.
You'll get used to it,
Anne said in a flat voice. Lying on my back again, my mind calmed. Despite the local anesthetic, I felt them tug and buzz at my leg. They sawed through the femur, twisting it so it would stand straight, then fused it together again using a flesh printer loaded with bone cells.
Carlos, why are you playing orderly?
I asked as they were sealing up my leg.
I should be asking you how I got this job, he said. Drusus ordered it. Specialist training, the last kind of specialist I've ever wanted to be. No offense, Anne, but being a bio totally blows. It's a disgusting and thankless job.
None taken,
Anne said in that same flat voice. I got the feeling she wasn't enjoying Carlos's company any more than he was enjoying his new assignment. I got to thinking of Carlos as a new bio. I visualized him working revival machines, caring for the sick, and recycling the dead. A rumble started in my chest somewhere. I don't know exactly where it came from. At first I thought it was a cough, but it turned out to be a laugh. Still laughing, I passed out and didn't wake up again for a long time. Summoned to see the Tribune, I hobbled through the tunnels on my weak leg. It was straight now and it would heal in time, but it still hurt pretty bad. Drusus looked me over when I arrived. He shook his head and whistled.
Still operating on a bad grow, veteran? He asked.
Graves said you were a chicken when it came to recycling, but I didn't believe it. You're so personally brave in other arenas. Why not embrace death in a quick revive? It solves so much. Frowning, I shook my head.
Sir, I've been patched up. The leg is straightened, and I'll be right as rain in a few days. I didn't want to bother the revival people. They've been churning out troops to replenish our losses for days.
That's true enough. Well, I guess it doesn't matter. Just try not to limp around Graves. It grates on him.
Words to live by, sir.
Now as to why I've summoned you. We've gotten confirmation from the Saurians that the ship Claver was on was destroyed.
He gave me a moment to let that sink in. Once it did, I frowned thoughtfully.
So Claver is dead,
right here in this system. He can't get a revive.
That's right, Drusa said. Not unless we give it to him. What do you think we should do?
I heaved a sigh. He helped us out in the end, I admitted. Without him, we'd have probably all been permed.
That's one way of looking at it. Another way is that without his meddling,
we might have never met up with the Saurians here. I think he was instrumental in bringing them to this system. What I don't understand is how he knew Earth was coming here at this exact time. I tossed Drusus a glance, then quickly looked away. I couldn't let him read my expression. It was my suspicion that Turov had collaborated with Klaver even before we headed out here. It wasn't clear exactly what their plans had been, but I was sure they were self-serving on both sides. He gave us the deep link, and he refused to fire the broadsides on opposition in the end. In fact, I think the Saurians probably executed him for that before any of their ships were lost against the Squids. What you say is quite possibly the truth, Drusa said. That's why I asked you to come here. Among everyone in Legion Varus, your perspective on this situation is unique. In short, we have options, and it's difficult to see how the future might be affected by the choices we make today. I thought about that. We could leave Klaver dead. Maybe the universe would be a better place if we did. But that was a hard choice for me to make. Klaver and I had a deal, and he'd kept his part of the bargain. Sir, I said. Klaver was a card-carrying bastard. That man could sell his soul to 6 different devils and swindle them all. But I made a deal with him. If my vote counts, I'd like to honor that deal. Drusus nodded slowly. I felt that would be your choice. Unfortunately, I think I'm going to have to go with my initial instinct and leave the man in his grave. Dismissed, veteran. He turned away and I was left standing there, blinking. My baffled expression transformed into one of annoyance. I shifted from foot to foot, then finally spoke up. Sir, I'm sorry, sir, but I just can't let this lie. Drusus frowned at me. He wasn't accustomed to non-coms arguing with him in his office. I could understand that, but I wasn't a man who could let something like that go so easily. What are you trying to say, McGill?
Tribune, why do you even ask me to come up here? I mean, if you had your mind made up, why bother?
Maybe I wanted to confirm something about you. Maybe I wanted to know how a man guided by principle over logic would judge a case such as this. Now that my curiosity has been satisfied, I'm moving on. A cold, callous answer. I should have been expecting nothing less. Tribune Drusus wasn't like Graves. He had a soul in there somewhere. But he also had a great deal of responsibility. He looked at things differently than I did, that's all. I left his office, troubled but resigned. Klaver was dead and gone. He was stardust, just like we all once were, and would be again someday. Chapter 51 Earth's Central Command was surprised to hear our plea on the deep link. They grumbled, but 3 long months after the battle with the Squids was over, Minotaur came back to Machine World to pick us up. We rode the lifters away from Machine World with a deep sense of relief. I'm not sure I've ever been happier to leave a planet behind. From space, the planet looked like a cotton ball. It was all fluffy white with clouds on top and soft blue grays underneath. The image belied the turmoil we'd gone through to survive on an intensely hostile world. Imperator Turov was aboard Minotaur, and I could tell right off she wasn't happy about that. Her face was a good 10 meters tall, displayed on the ceiling of our unit's module. When she spoke to us, she never cracked a smile. She showed her teeth plenty, sure, but that was only because her lips seemed to curl away from her pearly whites to punctuate every sentence.
"The heroic actions of Legion Varus have been duly noted," she said, sounding as if she was spitting out nails. "Hegemony has ordered me to provide every member of the Legion with the Medal of Honor, bronze rank. Congratulations and welcome aboard, Legionnaires."
A mild cheer went up from the assembled troops. It was nice to get a pat on the head from the brass every now and then, even if it came from the hogs back on Earth. Turov didn't beat around the bush when it came to my role in matters, either. She summoned me to her office on Gold Deck, and this time she had me thoroughly disarmed before I was allowed into her presence.
I found this stipulation disquieting, but I walked in as if I didn't have a care in the world. "Good morning, Imperator," I said. She eyed me coldly.
"James McGill,"
she said slowly.
"The man of the hour, if reports are to be believed."
"Happy to serve, sir. I just do my part the way any other man in the Legion would." She snorted.
"Hartley, what other non-com would dare insert his unwanted nose into every official matter that comes up?"
I didn't have an answer for that, so I kept quiet. I was standing at attention, staring at the back wall of her office. There was a picture of Earth there, stylized with an image of Central emblazoned over it. I found the image vaguely disturbing. What was it meant to project? The idea that hegemony's military ruled Earth? I told myself I was becoming paranoid and tried to listen to Turov instead. She was reading me a list of complaints by other officers concerning my conduct on Machine World. Even Leeson had a choice comment or two which had gone into my file. That hurt a bit, even if every word of it was true.
"The same old story, McGill," Turov said. "You show initiative, to a fault. You fight well, you lead well, but you constantly disobey even basic orders and place your commanders in compromising positions. Honestly, I'm not sure if you're a genius or an idiot."
"A bit of both, sir, if my mama is to be believed." She stared at me with hooded eyes.
"Let us get to the point. I came to this system with a plan. You're aware of this, yes?"
I took a chance and glanced at her directly. She had that wet cat look, tail lashing, pissed off. The cant of her hip as she leaned her shapely butt on her desk told the story, along with the way her arms were crossed and the fact that her eyes were glittering slits. Glancing back at the picture on the wall, I nodded.
"I gathered that you had a plan."
"Yes, sir."
"And yet, you sought to do whatever you damn well pleased, without regard for my requirements."
"Pardon me, sir," I said, "but am I here to be promoted, demoted, or just chewed out for the fun of it?"
"More insolence. I should never have become personally involved with you. That was a mistake, and it has come back to haunt me in countless ways."
Again I glanced down at her. I dared to give her a small, private smile. If it's any consolation, I have no regrets in that regard. I enjoyed myself thoroughly.
"Of course you did," she snapped. "As to your question about your future status, that remains to be seen."
I nodded. I was being judged. My fate was being decided. Calm and unconcerned, I went back to staring at the wall behind her.
"What arrangements did you have with Claver?"
she demanded.
"Why did he choose death rather than firing the broadsides for the Saurians?"
There she'd put her finger on it. For the first time I felt a tickle of sweat under my armpits. I couldn't tell her I'd agreed to steal the galactic key from her. That wouldn't do at all. "I believe all the details are in the report, sir," I said, deciding to play dumb.
"I've gone over and over all the reports. They're more than vague in this regard."
My face blank, I gave her the innocent, confused look I'd given 100 teachers, babysitters, and friends' moms as a kid. I was proud of that face, as it had gotten me out of countless bad spots in the past. "Honestly, I thought you might be able to shed some light on Claver's actions," I said. "He always was a bit of a mystery to me. I had no idea he was going to come out here and try to set up some kind of titanium trading depot." She glared at me and I looked back down at her, straight on.
"Did you know anything about that, sir?"
I asked.
"I've been meaning to ask you about it. Even more curious was Claver's knowledge that Earth was sending an expedition here in the first place. I mean, what are the odds that all these ships would show up in orbit over Machine World at the same time? There are coincidences in the universe, but this one is a doozy."
Turov's mouth got tighter with every word I uttered. By the end of my speech, her mouth was an almost invisible, pink, pinched-looking spot on her face,
Finally, as I knew she would, she exploded.
"That's enough with your threats," she said. "I could crush you. You know that, don't you? Even now, with your friends placed carefully all around the Legion, you're not safe from me. Don't think that you are."
My eyes were dead ahead again. "I'm sorry, sir, but I don't follow you." She began to pace around me, calming herself down with a force of will.
"All right," she said. "Keep your secrets, McGill. You're not being helpful at all. I'm faced with a difficult decision, and I'd hoped you would shed light on the subject, but you've chosen to be an obstinate ass, as usual."
What are we talking about now, sir?"
"About Claver, you fool. Should I revive him or not?"
That one took me by honest surprise. That's when I realized this dressing down wasn't about me at all. She was debating Claver's status. Their scheme, whatever it had been, had fallen apart. But maybe Claver had some hold over her, some promised prize she hadn't gotten out of him yet. If she left him dead, she'd never get it. That said, she clearly didn't trust the man, and wisely so. He was double-dealing everyone, up, down, and sideways. I heaved a sigh. "I made a deal with Claver," I said. "He agreed not to operate the broadsides for the Saurians, but he felt the Saurians might kill him for refusing."
"And why would he do that?"
she demanded. "To gain the trading rights he planned on in the first place. His first move was to arrive at the Squids and a trade ship, cutting a deal. When that failed, he tried a legal approach, back by the Nairbs. The man is nothing if not persistent. When I blew up the Nairb ship, he brought in the Saurians. Maybe he even knew the Squids were coming after that, or he called them. I'm honestly not sure."
"He's beyond slippery,"
Turov agreed reflectively.
"I now doubt my wisdom at ever having had dealings with him. Or you."
"He does keep his end of a bargain," I said. "He gave me the deep link to call Earth. Part of the deal was to revive him afterward if things went badly. In turn, he agreed not to help the Saurians fire the broadsides and demolish my Legion."
"Hmm," Turov said. "The whole thing almost makes sense. Parts of what you say were written in your superior's reports, but it was never stated so openly. Fair enough, you made a deal. What do you think now? Should I revive that rat or leave him dead in the gutter where he belongs?"
"I always try to honor a deal, sir," I said. "He kept his part of the bargain, and he paid the ultimate price as far as I can tell. I say revive him." She stopped pacing and stood directly in front of me, cocking her pretty face and gazing with open curiosity.
"You know that he'd betray you in a second, yes?"
"Yes and no, sir. He's a traitor. A man can't be successful in such a calling if he doesn't keep his deals most of the time. We might not know all his plans and deals, but I feel confident he will keep to the letter of a given bargain once it is agreed upon." She nodded thoughtfully.
"Yes, some things are beginning to make sense to me now. He knows you're a man who will keep a deal just as he himself would. He also knows he can talk you into foolish arrangements. Therefore, his real goal in contacting you must have been to gain an insurance policy. Perhaps he knew he was going to die. Maybe all that about the broadsides was bullshit, and the Saurians were going to kill him anyway. Who knows? What we can be sure of is he talked you into agreeing to revive him if he was killed. Now that he is dead, he hopes you will do so, even if you have to do it illicitly."
Turov gazed up at me with sudden suspicion.
"You've already done it, haven't you?"
Done what, sir?"
"Revived him. You have friends who are willing to do such things, I know that. I'm a woman who's built up a network of supporters. But you don't need to know about that, it doesn't matter. What I want to know is if you have brought him back yet. Have you, McGill?"
This was the sort of situation I was finding myself in more and more. People thought I was some kind of wizard. Sure, I'd gotten in and out of more than my share of scrapes, but I wasn't Houdini. "No, sir," I said. "Honestly, I haven't revived anyone since Tech World."
"All right. I choose to believe you. And I'll tell you right now, you should not bother. I'm going to do it. Quietly."
Surprised, I studied her. The look on her face was calculating, and she wasn't even looking at me. She was working her hands in the air and staring at the deck. I could only imagine what kind of scheming was going on inside that head of hers.
"Why tell me your intentions, sir?" I asked.
She looked back up at me as if she'd forgotten I was standing in front of her. She made a sweeping motion with her hand.
"So you wouldn't try to do it yourself out of some misguided sense of honor. You'd end up making a copy of him. That's all this universe needs. 2 Clavers. Now get the hell out of my office. You're dismissed."
Leaving in a hurry, I was left wondering about the conversation all the way back to my quarters. Whatever Claver and Turov were up to, it wasn't over with. Not yet. I had the feeling I wasn't going to like it when I learned the truth.
Chapter 52
2 months later, I was back home on Earth. Weary, and with the haunting light of the stars in our eyes, we marched down the ramps of our lifters, 6 abreast. A cheering crowd greeted us, bearing tiny flags, waving both Hegemony's blue globe and the Varus wolf's head pennant. They were mostly relatives, but there were a few others, members of the press, even Solstice people who felt sorry for the troops they'd left behind.
"Is it true that Varus wiped for a 4th time on Machine World?"
a reporter demanded, thrusting her audio wand into my face. A tiny camera drone buzzed over her shoulder, zooming and panning. "No," I said immediately. "We didn't wipe on Tech World. Not completely. I stayed alive and began the long revival process personally. On Machine World, it wasn't even close. We never lost more than half our..." The reporter was eating it up, but a pair of hands came out of nowhere and pushed her away. Leeson escorted her and that buzzing drone of hers back into the crowd and hustled me toward the terminal.
"That's enough, McGill," he said, pushing on my back.
He propelled me toward the welcoming crowd of relatives.
"Non-coms don't talk to the press. Never. Don't you know that?"
"Sorry, sir," I told the adjunct. Her questions had implied falsehoods. I wanted to set the record straight.
"That's the job of the officers, high-level ones. Your job is to keep your damn mouth shut."
"Yes, sir." My parents were in the crowd. They greeted me with enthusiasm, and my mom cried. She always did that. Every time I left and every time I came back.
"I'm good, Mom," I said.
She grabbed me by my jacket lapels and hung on tight, looking into my eyes.
"Did you die out there? They said that you all died."
"Nah, Mom," I said, smiling. "Not this time. Look, I've even got a slight limp. Do you see that? Just an injury, no death. If I died, that would have been all fixed up with a new grow. See?" My little dodge made her happy, and she cried all over again. I hugged them both and headed for the family tram. I was on leave, and I was looking forward to spending a few spring months in my own place on the back of their land. The best part was my home planet's air. I'd been breathing farts on Machine World, followed by the canned, stale air on Minotaur for half a year. In comparison, the fresh breezes of Earth were like heaven. That night, I drank a dozen cold beers and passed out happily on my couch. One of the many times I had to get up to pee, I heard a knocking on my door. It was a timid knock, the kind someone who was unsure of themselves might make. Sighing, I headed to the door and threw it wide. I had no idea who might be visiting me. It could have been any of a dozen people. By the light of the moon outside, I judged it was the middle of the night and therefore couldn't be one of my parents, but that was about the only people I'd ruled out. My eyes focused in the darkness. Small, female. I thought of Natasha first. She'd come to my door like this on many occasions.
but it wasn't her.
Della?
I almost said the name out loud, but I caught myself in time. It wasn't her. It couldn't be her. She'd headed back to Dustworld to visit her own family.
Anne?
I said, surprised.
How'd you find me way out here?
She smiled shyly.
I asked around. They said you lived alone, but isn't that your parents' place, over there behind the trees?
Yeah, but don't worry, they're asleep now. You want to come in? She did so with the mild trepidation all females seem to exhibit when entering my lair. The interior was dark because I liked it that way. Soft blue lights glowed here and there, illuminating various appliances. There was only one major place to sit, my couch. She headed there and pushed a few cushions and a thin blanket out of the way.
You want a beer?
I asked.
Ah, hold on, I'm out. How about a margarita and a can?
Sure. I brought it to her, and she sipped it quietly.
I'm sorry I didn't call first or text you,
she said, speaking quickly.
I didn't even know I was coming. I was driving around, and I thought I'd just drop by and see where you lived. Once I was here, well, I thought it would be silly not to knock on your door.
Unperturbed, I nodded. The fact that she lived up in Kentucky didn't impinge. It was quite a distance to be wandering late at night. If a man had done the same, they'd call him a stalker. I grinned at the thought, and although I still had a gut full of beer in me, I was smart enough not to say what was on my mind. Eventually, we got around to the real reason she'd come to my place. We had a great time on the couch. But I didn't remember it very well by morning, so we repeated the process after cleaning up. After that, we went out to breakfast. There, at a local eatery, we ran into my parents. They were looking at us in embarrassment, not sure if they should say anything or not. I walked over to them, carrying my plate, and followed, mortified.
James, she hissed. They'll know I spent the night. They'll have to figure it out.
They already know, I said. They aren't stupid, just make the best of it. We sat together, talked, and ate. It was nice, and it was something I rarely did. I usually kept my private life and my family apart. Consequently, my mother was ready to maul poor Anne. I could see she had wedding cakes in her eyes and bells in her ears. It was all I could do not to laugh. Anne brought up the squids. I wished she hadn't. They kind of freaked my mother out.
I've heard about those huge, disgusting creatures, my mom said. Did you actually see one?
Anne gave me a wary glance. Obviously, my parents were in the dark concerning my activities while abroad among the stars. I generally edited my stories of warfare. They didn't need to know how bad it really was to be a legionnaire. I think my dad suspected, of course. When I candied up my tales of the campaigns, he always smiled with his mouth, but not his eyes. He'd always been able to tell when I was lying better than my mom, back as far as I could remember. Giving Anne a tiny nod, I took a drink of coffee and stared into the cup. Anne cleared her throat and started in.
There was this one cephalopod that was different from the rest, she said. It was huge, and it turns out it was a female.
This detail surprised even me. Anne and I hadn't talked about the campaign. We'd been too busy enjoying one another's company all night for that.
Female? I asked. How could you tell?
Anne laughed.
They have sexes. You just have to look. Every squid we've found up until this trip to Gamma Pavonis has been male. But I've had contact with the team of bios who were tasked with investigating the one you found in that big tank. It was a confirmed female.
You found it?
My mother gasped, staring at me across the table. I had a fork full of pancakes in my hand, and I froze.
You never talked about that, James,
she said, raising her voice. My dad put a hand on her arm. Hon, you have to know that he doesn't tell us everything.
You'd think he wouldn't leave out a giant space squid, which he found himself, apparently.
I didn't actually find it first, I said. Carlos and Kiwi did, but I did see it before it died. My parents eyed me warily. I could tell they wanted to ask exactly how the giant space squid had died,
but they didn't.
Sorry, Anne said. I shouldn't have brought it up. No, no,
my mom chimed in and immediately began trying to make Anne feel better. They started chatting again about more pleasant things. My mom had switched gears. I could tell she was focused on getting me married off again. Oddly, that was a relief to everyone at the table. The day went by pleasantly after that, and after staying on for the weekend, Anne headed back to Kentucky. I found myself missing her almost immediately. About a month later, my door thumped again. It was the middle of the day, not the middle of the night, but for some reason I thought it was Anne coming back around for another visit. I pasted my hair down as best I could with the few seconds I dared let pass before opening it. When I finally did, my grin faded to blank shock. It wasn't Anne at all. Claver stood there with two centurions. They were in hog uniforms, and Claver was in civvies. My eyes ran from one of them to the next.
Disappointed? Claver asked, chuckling. I have that effect on a lot of people. Come on, McGill. You've been summoned to a meeting.
What meeting?
One of the centurions stepped forward with written orders. They were signed by none other than Equestrian Nagata, the man who I'd met with months back. My heart sank. This had to be about Turov and the Galactic we'd killed. That hadn't seemed like an action I'd get away with forever.
Summoned? To Central?
That's right, Vet. You coming peacefully? The man was eyeing me, sizing me up. I felt that was a little insulting. Sure, I'd resisted arrest before, but this was different. I was being called by a high-level officer to Central. They had written orders and everything. The orders seem legit, I said. I'm not under arrest, am I?
Are you refusing the orders? The centurion asked.
No, sir.
Then you're not under arrest.
I followed them out to a military air car. It wasn't as nice as the one Winslade had swept me away in months ago, but it was just as fast. We glided over the treetops and soon slipped up into the regulated air traffic corridors. Applying full thrust, the two centurions whisked me away toward the northeast. Sitting in the back seat beside Claver, I couldn't help but talk to him. "Congratulations on breathing again, by the way," I said.
"Thank you," he replied. "I'm equally impressed by the fact you haven't gotten yourself permed yet. I might have misjudged your intellect, McGill. A man can't get lucky so many times by sheer accident."
"Why doesn't anyone like to warn me about these pickups?" I complained. "People just come to my house whenever. They could at least send me a note first." Claver shook his head.
"Notes? On tappers? Maybe you are a dummy. That would leave an undeniable trace in the computers. If people keep coming to your door unannounced, McGill, it's because they don't want anyone to know they've done it. I, for one, am unsurprised to hear people don't want to make their associations with you public."
I thought about Anne, then, and Natasha. Had they come knocking unannounced because they feared leaving a trace of their visits? The thought was disturbing. Could I be that toxic to a woman's career? Claver didn't want to talk business in the back of a military air car with two witnesses, so we discussed pleasantries all the way up to Central. At last, after we landed and we were walking across the roof, Claver slapped my hand with his. I looked down at his offending hand and frowned.
"What?" "Give it to me," he whispered. "And don't tell me you didn't bring it. No one would leave it in a shack unguarded, not even you."
"Give you what?" He looked at me like I was the dumbest animal on the farm.
"The key, you idiot. Are you backing out because I don't like Welshers, McGill?"
"I don't have it," I growled back at him. "Not yet. I told you to give me a year."
"Shit," he said.
He shoved his hands back into his pockets. When we were led into Equestrian Nagata's office, the two centurions retreated. The first time I'd met this man, he'd been in the mustering hall in Newark.
but the headquarters building in Central was his home office. As a hog officer, he belonged here. Claver and I stood there like kids in the principal's office, while Nagata fooled around with some computer scrolls on his big brass-studded desk. At last he looked up.
"Adjunct Claver,"
he said, nodding, then turned to me.
"And Veteran McGill. Two of the most infamous rogues on Frontier 921.
He riffled through his computer scrolls and selected two of them. He slid one across his desk toward each of us. I glanced down. Whatever it looked like an official document. Equestrian Nagata's scrawled signature was at the bottom of both.
"What's this, sir?"
I asked.
"What do you think it is?"
he asked me in return.
"An agreement to avoid prosecution, provided you give us the testimony we're asking for."
Frowning, we both picked up our documents and looked them over. Claver read a few words.
"Immunity, immediate release, record stricken, good enough, I'm signing."
He touched his thumb to the bottom, and an image of his print appeared on the scroll. I looked mine over with far less enthusiasm. I had no idea what I was facing, and as I paged through the scroll, it wasn't getting any clearer.
"Sir,"
I asked, "I don't understand what this is about."
"You're trading your testimony for immunity. You're the small fish, McGill. It's standard practice to allow a few lesser criminals to escape the net in order to capture the big one."
"And who is the big one in this case, sir?"
"Imperator Turov, of course."
"And the charge?"
"In Claver's case, the charge is sedition and racketeering. In your case, it's murder. Namely, the murder of Chief Inspector Zalur. Imperator Turov is guilty of both these crimes."
I'd known the answer to my question before asking it, naturally. I just wanted it confirmed. I glowered at the document. It seemed so dirty. Was I going to let Turov hang out to dry? She'd never been a stellar officer, and she was often up to no good. But I felt uncomfortable saddling her with things I'd done at her side.
"Sir,
the Galactics aren't behind this prosecution, are they?"
"Fortunately, no. If they ever do bring charges, we'll all be permed. These charges are relatively minor. Murder, disobeying orders, endangering the state, the sort of thing you two excel at."
I could tell Nagata didn't like me or Claver. He'd apparently lumped us into the same pot, calling us both troublemakers and criminals. That didn't sit well with me.
"Sir,"
I said, "are you aware of the circumstances that led to the unfortunate death of a foreign dignitary on our soil?" Nagata stared at me.
"The chief inspector is not a foreign dignitary. He is a galactic, part of the empire we all serve."
"You should think that over, sir."
"McGill,"
Claver said at my side. He'd been quiet up until now, but he'd been growing increasingly alarmed.
"Shut that big crack of mouth of yours for the love of God, and sign."
I ignored him and stayed focused on Nagata. I pointed at Claver. "This man will tell you whatever you want to hear. He'll sell Turov, or you for that matter, down the river of your choice without a qualm. But, sir, I'm made of different stuff. Honestly, killing Zalur has probably been one of the best things I've ever done. Turov should be commended for her action as well, whatever other faults she might have. Zalur meant to perm everyone on Earth. We did what we did because we had to, and now, as a big thank you for saving your collective butts, you've decided to perm us as a reward? I don't get it, sir, not at all."
"They aren't going to perm you, McGill, just Turov,"
said Claver. I turned on him. "And is that what you want? You want Turov arrested, tried, and executed? What do you think will happen during that sequence of events?" Claver's face froze. He got it. If the hogs caught and tried Turov on the basis of our testimony, he'd never get his key. Turov would either use it to escape her fate, or it would be confiscated.
"I've had a change of heart, sir,"
he said suddenly. He rubbed his fingers side to side over his mark on the computer scroll until it vanished, then tossed the scroll back on the equestrian's desk where it rattled with the rest of the documents.
"I'm sorry."
Nagata's mouth hung open. He swept his eyes back and forth between the two of us.
He was surprised, but thinking hard.
"She's got something on you, too,"
he said.
"Something so bad, you're willing to risk trial to avoid it. That's got to be quite a lever. I'm impressed by this woman's scheming. Your case isn't unique, you know. I've had my eye on her for years, trying to stop her. Always my evidence falls apart at the last minute. She has friends in very high places. But she has just as many enemies."
We both gazed at him evenly. I knew now what I was caught up in. A vendetta. A squabble between high-ranking officers. For a mere enlisted man, that wasn't a pleasant place to be, let me tell you. Nagata stood up suddenly. His body was stiff and angry.
"I won't bother to tempt you with bribes. If the threat of prosecution won't sway you from serving your mistress, rank and bank accounts would have even less of an effect. However, my offer stands, and I will seek to come up with a further offer you can't refuse. Know, gentlemen, that I'm a patient man, and that I'll win this contest in the end. You cannot prevail in this political battle in the long run."
"Ah," Claver said uncertainly. "You said something about an incentive program, sir. Are you sure you don't want to provide more details on that?"
"Get out!"
That was it. We were thrown out of Nagata's office and out of the gigantic headquarters building as well. Claver and I went our separate ways almost immediately. I had to wonder why Nagata didn't have us arrested. But the answer to that puzzle was easy to figure out. When a fisherman seeks to catch a really big fish, he baits the hook with a small one. Then he lets the line pay out, far, far from the boat. I went home to Waycross, Georgia, knowing in my heart I was being watched. I was the bait, and that meant I was already on the hook. I didn't like the sensation. Not at all.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Death World, Book 5 in the Undying Mercenary series free.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Machine World, Undying Mercenaries, Book 4. Written by B.V. Larson. Performed by Mark Boyette. Producer, Mike Charzak. Copyright 2015 by B.V. Larson. Production copyright 2015 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
And now a free preview of Death World, Book 5 in the Undying Mercenary series.
Chapter 1. After living on Machine World in the Gamma Pavona system for months, coming home to Earth felt like a vacation in paradise. On my home world, the skies were blue, the air was clean, and it was blissfully warm even in the dead of winter. Machine World, by comparison, was a frozen hell. The land was permanently overcast and devoid of organic life. Instead of water, methane filled the seas and fell from the skies in flakes, forming alien snowstorms. The electromechanical beings that lived there could be friendly, but they weren't very bright, and their natural hunger for metals drove them to aggression when they encountered armored humans. In short, I didn't miss the place at all. My hometown was Waycross in Georgia Sector. My parents owned a small plot of land there near the Satilla River. I'd taken up residence in a dimly lit shack on their back acreage. It had a portable fridge, creaky floorboards, and a sagging couch to sleep on. It wasn't much to look at, but I called it home. Ann Grant, a Legion bio I'd had a thing for over the years, spent a few happy days with me in that shack after our return to Earth. But one gray afternoon, she said her goodbyes and drove back up to Kentucky. I knew I'd miss her, but I felt comfortable about our parting. She was one to be remembered. Seeing that yet another girl had come and gone from my life and possibly feeling wrong-headedly sorry for me, my parents took me out to dinner the same night Anne left. They told me all the local news while driving home in the family tram.
Like a good son, I hunched in the tight back seat, nodding, grunting, and pretending to listen. They no longer bothered to ask for any of my stories. The details